Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on the program, the 36th annual Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities is taking place in Eatonville, January 31st through February 2nd.
Each of the festivals, I think, over the decades has had, you know, a consistent quality of excellence. But there are some years, frankly, when we just outdo ourselves, and this is one of them.
We'll discuss labor conflicts and unionism in Tampa.
Eugene Poulneau and Mabel Hagan rose and fell quickly in the national memory, but the positions they took and defended, the right to employment and a decent wage, had long-term implications for the working poor.
And we'll talk about Cubans in Jim Crow, Florida. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
When I get in the Illinois, I'm going to spread the news about the Florida boys. Shove it over.
Hey, that's writer, folklorist, and anthropologist Zora Neale Hurston singing a Florida work song that she collected and preserved in 1933. Since 1990, the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community has been presenting the Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities with the goals of considering the life and work of Zora Neale Hurston, the historic significance of her hometown of Eatonville, and the cultural contributions that people of African ancestry have made to the United States and the world. This year begins a new 5-year thematic cycle for the Zora Festival. It's an exploration of place and place-making. I spoke with PEC Executive Director N.Y. Nathiri about what the theme means for Eatonville and positive economic development in the historic African-American town.
Looking at Eatonville, looking at, frankly, the cultural heritage tourism marketplace that is not just a niche in the hospitality industry, but a recognized cohort, if you will, of business that assumes authenticity, that assumes an audience that is interested in experiences that help them to better understand and enjoy a place. And frankly, I would say over the last maybe 15 to 20 years within the field of historic preservation, there has been this kind of movement in terms of understanding the significance of place as a part of the historic preservation context.
The academic conference portion of this year's Zora Festival begins January 29th with a presentation by author and historian Leslie Kemp Poole at Seminole State College. Days 2 and 3 of the academic conference are in Eatonville with presentations on the theme Reimagining Space and Place, Historic Black Communities Across the Diaspora. The conference is being held in the historic St. Lawrence AME Church,
which is a congregation that has been active in the town for over 140 years. It actually is older. The congregation itself is older than the incorporation of the town, having been organized in 1881. And when we talk about the diaspora, we have scholars literally from not just around the country, but also from outside of the country, the United Kingdom, sending us a scholar. And so what you have in these 2 days is a looking at place from different perspectives. It's very exciting to be able to present this level of discussion.
The Zora Festival appeals to all age groups, including pre-K through 12th grade, And this year, there are a variety of offerings beginning on January 31st, which is traditionally Education Day.
And I think that we need to start off by bringing to the attention of the audience the Florida Historical Society's traditional role with the festival. Over the years, the FHS has presented theatrical performances, has presented exhibitions, in addition to the really very fine exhibitions and tent materials at the Outdoor Festival. So yes, that's a standard of which we are, that collaborative relationship we're very proud of. And this year, it will be amplified by a wonderful assemblage of Zora STEM offerings through the Orlando Science Center, through the University of Central Florida, through the esteemed learning and the Zeta Phi Beta sorority. Please visit zorafestival.org and look at the education offerings at the Outdoor Festival. Fossil hunters, bees, rockets, all kinds of things that I would say anyone who has the ability to get a child involved or engaged, you will be doing a great service to bring that child out. On Education Day, when adults are also free, children are free Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. But on Saturday and Sunday, we do have a gate admission for adults. But on Friday, adults can come without cost as well.
In addition to hands-on activities for kids during Education Day, there are opportunities for local students to showcase their talents, including performances on the festival main stage. NY Nefiri.
The main stage will be curated by Orange County Public Schools, and those are the performances. And in the town hall, the town council chambers of Eatonville, there will be an art gallery of students' works. This is really, you know, I was, each time I talk about this, I'm more effusive because, of course, each of the festivals, I think, over the decades has had, you know, a consistent quality of excellence. But there are some years, frankly, when we just outdo ourselves. And this is one of them. It's so appropriate, you know, that this is the kickoff to a new cycle, that we are in Eatonville, and that the collaborative partners, and that's where this all comes. This is a wonderful expression of collaborative relationships throughout the arts and cultural community. So, you know, scarf off to our partners.
The Zora Festival is in its 36th year, so some people may feel like they've been there, done that. But as NY Nethiri explains, there's always something new and intellectually stimulating at the festival.
We have been able to meet that challenge, and so it's very exciting. It's very exciting to see how people look forward to the event, and then they notice, you know, they notice that that things are different, that there are new features, and they appreciate that. So yes, we're very pleased that our audience is responsive to the advances that we try to make.
NY Nethiri is executive director of the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community. The 36th annual Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities is taking place January 31st through February 2nd in Eatonville with music, craft vendors, food trucks, and more.
He got a pistol, he tried to play bad, but I'm gonna take it if it make me mad. Shove it over, hey, can't you lie now? I shake a like a, can't you move it? Hey, or can't you try?
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org.
Solidarity forever.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, unlike most cities in the South, Tampa has a long history of labor conflict and unionism. The Cuban and Italian cigar workers in Ybor City displayed especially strong associations with their labor organizing, but the labor activism by workers participating in New Deal programs raised new issues.
In two articles, one published in a 2006 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly and the second published in a 2009 issue of the Journal of American History, Elna Green analyzed the activities of two individuals who personified the labor unrest that demonstrated the growing precariousness of union activism in 1930s Tampa and foretold the emergence of welfare activism in post-World War II America. As Green explains, Tampa was, quote, one of the most ethnically diverse cities in the South and had the largest Socialist Party vote in the region, reliably recording 2,000 votes in every presidential election from 1904 to 1928. In the presidential election of 1912, Socialist candidate Eugene Ebbs outpolled Republican President William Howard Taft by 527 votes, with Debs receiving 9.3% of the state's votes. Although Ybor City was notable for the strength of its labor activism, other Florida cities also experienced labor unrest at the end of World War I, including strikes by phosphate workers in Polk and Hillsborough counties, construction workers in Miami, and shipyard workers in Pensacola. Jacksonville witnessed repeated episodes of labor unrest from its 36 AFL locals, with violence regularly accompanying repeated walkouts. The reemergence of the Ku Klux Klan in 1915 contributed to the violence surrounding labor unrest. Green's two articles focus on the labor activism of Eugene Poulneau and Mabel Hagan, who challenged the poor wages paid to WPA workers during the New Deal. After their short period of activism, 1935 to 1937, and a brief rise to national attention, they disappeared from history. But she argues their challenges offer insights into the labor divisions in Tampa and suggest an early example of welfare rights that will become more prominent in the 1960s.
Connie, Eugene Poulneau had been part of the labor movement most of his working life, although he rose to the attention of Floridians after a horrific beating he endured at the hands of a group of men who abducted him outside the Tampa police station.
Poulneau was a native Floridian, a World War I veteran, a husband and father to four children. Living with his parents and frequently unemployed, he was a member of the printers' union, but lost his membership when he could no longer pay his dues. The Great Depression compounded his employment problems until he finally obtained employment with the Works Progress Administration, the WPA. In December 1933, Poulneau wrote to Harry Hopkins, the National Director of the Civil Works Administration, on behalf of the Unemployed Brotherhood of Hillsborough County, to complain about discrimination in pay rates on work relief projects. The following May, he was arrested as he gave an incendiary speech at a rally of relief workers, again demanding pay increases. Shortly afterward, his name appeared on a list of radicals under surveillance by U.S. military intelligence. In 1935, the Unemployed Brotherhood became the Socialist Party-supported Workers' Alliance, and Poulneau emerged as the Hillsborough County head of the union. The Workers' Alliance joined with the newly formed Modern Democratic Party in an attempt to overthrow the powerful local Democratic leadership. On November 30, 1935, Poulneau and several others were removed from a meeting in a private home by Tampa police. Interrogated about their alleged affiliation with the Communist Party, they were released without charges into the night. Outside the police station, they were seized by a group of men, taken to a remote area, stripped and beaten before being tarred and feathered and left to die. One of the men, Joseph Shoemaker, died in the hospital 9 days later. The beatings made national news, and 11 men were eventually indicted on various charges. Pouneau rightly believed his life was in danger, and indeed a Tampa newspaper reflected popular opinion that, quote, the floggings were only the beginning of a series that would put the fear of God in political and social agitators and deter them from attempting to interfere with machine politics, end quote, in the upcoming 1936 primary election. As the trials got underway, allegations of communism, not kidnapping, beatings, and murder, dominated courtroom and public attention. Surprisingly, 5 men were convicted of kidnapping charges in the first trial. In subsequent trials, the charges were dismissed, and no one ever served prison time for the murder of Joseph Shoemaker or the flogging of Eugene Pouneau. Demanding higher wages and challenging entrenched local political power created lifelong problems for Pouneau and his family. They frequently depended on the charity of supporters to afford rent and food, as Pouneau's reputation and lack of pressman's credentials made it difficult for him to find work. Pouneau faded into obscurity and died in January 1976.
Connie, Pouneau was also involved in the second example of labor activism toward New Deal programs, the sit-down strike to protest the firing of 88 women in a Tampa sewing room and simultaneously draw attention to the minuscule wages paid to the workers, ended with little drama, but was nonetheless an important development in Tampa's labor history.
In 1937, a second challenge to the wage structure of the WPA was mounted by Mabel Hagen and her co-workers at one of the sewing rooms scattered across Tampa. The sewing rooms produced clothing that was distributed to nonprofit organizations. But sewing rooms were an afterthought in the efforts by the WPA to put people back to work. People meant men, who earned wages to support their families. Women were largely ignored by WPA programs. Sewing rooms were organized when it became apparent that women, divorced and widowed, with children to provide for, and elderly women without family to care for them, needed work and an income. Most of the women in sewing rooms had not been previously employed and had no experience with union organizing. On July 1, 1937, the WPA drastically cut their workforce in sewing rooms across the nation. Of the 400 women employed in the sewing room where Mabel Hagen worked, 88 lost their jobs. The women quickly organized a sit-down strike, a new form of labor protest, and demanded reinstatement of the released workers and a 20% increase in pay. Initially supported by the community, the women were supplied with food and other necessities to maintain the strike. Eugene Pouneau was tasked with encouraging other sewing rooms to join the strike. Officials feared the image that a violent reaction to the strike would present and simply waited out the strikers. With no experience in organizing and sustaining a strike, and with no sympathy strikes to support them, the sit-down strike lost momentum. A week after it began, it ended, but the WPA pattern of unpredictable employment and low wages continued. Two examples of labor radicalism that failed to achieve their goals. Green argues that they were important for what they tell us about local political and labor dynamics in the context of national labor and welfare changes. The first observation is one of spatial and ethnic racial identification. The dispersal of the sewing rooms across the city meant that the women workers identified with a neighborhood, not the larger context of sewing room solidarity. Sewing rooms were segregated, and there was no solidarity across ethnic or racial lines. The second observation involves the role of unions. The women in the sewing rooms seldom had any previous experience with unions, unless they had worked in the cigar industry. Neither the AFL nor the new CIO embraced the strikers, and the strike itself was a new tactic that the sewing room strikers knew only that sit-down strikes produce more reactions from officials, not how to navigate and sustain such a tactic. Green offers one last observation with long-term implications. The women had little understanding of the unions, but they believed they had a right to their work relief positions based on their needs and their citizenship. They were the deserving poor. In that regard, they express a position that would become more forcefully argued with the emergence of the welfare rights movements in the 1960s. Eugene Poulneau and Mabel Hagan rose and fell quickly in the national memory, but the positions they took and defended, the right to employment and a decent wage, had long-term implications for the working poor.
A fascinating story about important activism. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly.
Solidarity forever, for the Union makes us strong.
This is Florida Frontiers. Sebastian Garcia explores the often overlooked impact of Jim Crow laws in Florida on Cubans.
Arturo Sebastian Gonzalez is a PhD candidate at the University of Miami. His research focuses on Cubans' transnational politics, particularly how that unfolded in places like Florida. I spoke with Arturo about a presentation he recently delivered titled, quote, No Cubans Allowed, Diplomatic Interventions and Racial Boundaries in Jim Crow Florida, end quote. In 1915, the owner of Goldstein's Pool, located significantly north of the Latin enclaves of Ybor City and West Tampa, banned Cubans from the pool on the grounds that the Cuban patrons spoke loud and in their native language, made their presence noticeable, and behaved disorderly, especially compared to the American patrons. The explicitness of the sign, which read, quote, No Cubans Allowed, end quote, and ensuing justification generated heated debates between the Anglo and Cuban communities of Greater Tampa, most notably led by the local diplomat for the Cuban Republic, Rafael Ybor. Such discourses highlight how Cubans complicated the racial and social order of Jim Crow.
In a letter that was actually sent to the Clearwater Sun, an unnamed individual in a letter to the editor, he wrote that Consul Ybor was taking himself too seriously, that he should devote his energies to Americanizing his people. And he also mentioned that Cubans were driving the white people from another establishment, the Paso Grill. This statement in passing is actually quite interesting, because by saying that Cubans were driving the white people from Paso Grill, of course, the implication is that Cubans themselves are not part of the white people. And that, again, blows open this social order of Jim Crow, how it affected people, not just legally, but socially. Because legally, Cubans, at least those who were white passing, people who were not Afro-Cuban, they were legally white. Under U.S. law, they were allowed to naturalize. They had legally all the rights of being white. But just because they were white, legally, socially, they were not exactly white. They were not quite white as the Anglo population was. And so we see that clearly demonstrated in these letters to the editor.
Ignoring the unnamed individual's comment that he took himself too seriously and that the owner did not reinstall the sign once someone stole it in August 1915, Ybor relentlessly pursued the case further, consequently negotiating the legality of Cuban whiteness.
Consul Ybor filed an injunction with the local court. The judge refused to sign it. And we see that Consul Ybor, he is relentless. I mean, he goes to the local officials, the local court, the federal court. He inquires in officials in Tallahassee about the legality of this. His superiors submit a complaint to the U.S. Department of State. Consul Ybor also tries to start a personal PR campaign. He says that such discrimination, if allowed to go unchecked, might lead to ill feeling between the American and Latin races that I hope will never exist between the two principal parts of Tampa's white population. So we see there, much less subtly, you know, he's making the case that the Cubans were unambiguously white. And more than that, they were one of the two principal pillars of whiteness in the city. And so they were, he was trying to establish, crucial to the maintenance of the social order in the city. They were, in fact, part of that upper racial strata, and their rights ought to be respected just as much as any other white population.
Ybor's efforts to litigate the Goldstein Pool ban proved unsuccessful, as his superiors in Havana forced him to drop the issue entirely. Arturo argues that Ybor's adherence to this order highlights how his class position as a social elite working for the Cuban Republic prevented any serious advancement of civil rights for Cubans during this period. More distressingly, the Goldstein Pool affair illuminates one of the most enduring legacies of the Jim Crow era, the informal enforcement of knowing your race and knowing your place in society.
This is demonstrative of the longest lasting legacy of Jim Crow. Even once the sign is taken down, Cubans were still not going to be allowed into the pool. If you read between the lines, that's the unspoken conclusion. And that is, of course, how Jim Crow segregation evolved after the civil rights movement. Yeah, you have a legal right to be here, but if we return to the very beginning of this story, when it was reported in the local newspaper, the manager of the pool promised publicly that he would find another way to keep Cubans and others of the Latin race from patronizing the pool. And it seems like he succeeded. And in many such cases across not just the South, but across the entirety of the United States, we see that this kind of informal enforcement of social norms based on race, of who is acceptable to be seen in certain public spaces, we see that it continues to be enforced, but just silently. And that ultimately is a lot harder to address and is still something that in our society needs to be addressed.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brookmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.